The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
India sees a dramatic spike in coronavirus cases. Public health leaders there say the country is setting the right priorities to manage it.
Early detection of cases, more efficient contact tracing, and cutting down the infectivity rate, even as we are taking care of the people who are already infected.
I'm Carol Hills. We'll look at how a country of 1.3 billion people is dealing with the coronavirus. Also today, the U.S. is punishing the chief prosecutor at the International Criminal Court.
The intent of these sanctions is to, at the very least, intimidate, you know, and scare off ICC officials from doing their job.
And in Ghana,
the colors are very bright. In fact, we are color crazy.
A company makes COVID-inspired fabrics. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It seems like a sprint, and why shouldn't it be? The race for a COVID-19 vaccine is about getting us out of this global pandemic as fast as possible. Clinical trials have ramped up in the U.S., U.K., China, Australia, and elsewhere. But here's a lingering question, and it's a big one. If or when there is an effective vaccine, who gets it? The coronavirus pandemic knows no borders. In the race for a vaccine, however, it's not so clear that everybody's on the same team. Here's The World's Alana Gordon.
One of the first things running through Jane Halton's mind back in February, before the coronavirus had turned full-on pandemic, was about who would have access to an eventual vaccine. Because past pandemics offered some cautionary tales. During the 2009 H1N1 flu pandemic, there was a clear division between the haves and the have-nots.
All of the wealthy countries basically bought up supply of vaccine, and the less wealthy countries and some of the smaller countries found it very hard to get access.
Halton is former head of Australia's health and finance departments. She chairs a global organization that grew out of H1N1, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, or CEPI. Today, the group is leading the effort to prevent a repeat of what happened during H1N1.
How do we purchase for all of the people who need vaccine across poor countries and people who can self-finance? And then how do we distribute to the people most in need first around the world so we can bring this to a speedy conclusion?
To do this, CEPI, the World Health Organization, and the main group that funds vaccines in low-income countries, called Gavi, created an initiative called COVAX.
The COVAX pillar aims to ensure that every country gets fair and equitable access to eventual COVID-19 vaccines. It does this by acting as an insurance policy with the largest portfolio of vaccine candidates in the world.
This is their online video explaining how it works. Countries choose to join, the wealthier ones contribute funds, the big pool then supports the development and production of different vaccines. The idea is that if one or several of those vaccines prove effective, COVAX would have the leverage to buy and distribute vaccines, ideally 2 billion doses, in an equitable way.
If we start now, we can save hundreds of thousands of lives.
So far, about 170 countries are in talks to participate. This morning, a representative from one of those nations, the Republic of Equatorial Guinea, explained why he was on board.
The COVID-19, it is also a test on our human ingenuity to transcend our individualities and destroy all barriers looking to act with a common purpose.
Mitoha Ondoo Ayakaba was speaking during a WHO conference call. He said being part of a bigger pool ensures his country can actually compete with bigger ones to get an effective vaccine. This week, COVAX got a major boost from one of those bigger players.
The European Commission is ready to join the COVAX facility.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen also pledged money for the effort.
We will join COVAX together with our EU member states as Team Europe. And the Commission will also make a contribution of 400 million euro in guarantees to the COVAX facility and its goals.
COVAX needs billions of dollars and as many countries on board as possible. But one country that won't be joining this effort is the United States. The White House is critical of the World Health Organization and China and said in a statement that it doesn't want to be constrained by a multilateral organization. The move worries Lawrence Gostin. He's a professor of global health law at Georgetown University and an advisor to the WHO.
COVAX is the world's one chance to actually rally together for the most important medical commodity in our lifetimes, which is a highly safe and effective COVID vaccine, and probably many vaccines, because we don't know which ones are going to work best.
For Suri Moon, co-director of the Global Health Center at the Graduate Institute in Geneva, the U.S. action sets a negative precedent, but she says it won't necessarily cripple COVAX.
U.S. rejection of the COVAX facility and effort, it's a real shame. But at the same time, the COVAX facility still can deliver a lot. I think there's still a lot of potential, very strong political backing, and certainly a lot of interest from countries around the world in making it work.
Moon says there are big challenges ahead. Wealthy countries may try to buy up vaccines for themselves, whether or not they're participating in COVAX. That could make it harder for COVAX to get the same access. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
India is looking at some terrible coronavirus numbers right now. It took almost 6 months for the country to record a million cases of COVID-19. 3 weeks later, it was up to 2 million. And then in just 16 days, it was 3 million. Today, India reported another record single-day jump in cases, more than 83,000 new cases. That means India is on track to become the second hardest-hit country in the world after the United States. Yet India is also entering its Unlock 4.0 phase to get the economy going again. What's going on? Professor Srinath Reddy is the president of the Public Health Foundation of India. Professor Reddy, India is experiencing the fastest growing caseload of any country in the world, yet it's entering a new phase of reopening the country. I mean, this is going to include reopening subway trains for the first time in months, beginning Monday. What's going on here? What's this strategy about?
Well, it's true that the rapid rise of cases is a matter of concern. However, the cases as well as the deaths will have to be also adjusted for the population size of India. Now, any rise in cases is certainly not welcome, and every death should be prevented. However, if you look at the actual death rate, it is still just about 50 per million, which is much less than that of many countries like in Western Europe and United States. I believe it is absolutely necessary that we do give public health a priority and certainly keep the deaths under control. But at the same time, since there is a sense of urgency being felt to revive the economy, which has gone into a slump, the policy at this point in time seems to be to continue the containment measures while opening up the economy simultaneously.
But do you think that the deaths per million, the reported deaths per million, are accurate? Could there be many more deaths that are just not being counted?
It is possible, just as elsewhere in the world, we may be undercounting our deaths, particularly out-of-hospital deaths, and some of the deaths in the hospital could be misclassified. It can be twofold maximum. But even then, compared to other countries in Western Europe or the United States, it would still not be very high. And in other parts of South Asia, if you see, again, the same phenomenon is seen. The death rates in South Asia have been very low in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and therefore India is not having a unique experience. And similar experience is being reported from Africa as well. In Africa, we are seeing the deaths are still pretty much on the lower side.
In the case of India and Africa, for that matter, what do you believe is accounting for the lower death rate?
Well, one of the main factors is the younger age of the population. We know that in Europe as well as in North America, the older age of the population was an important factor, partly because age itself depresses immunity slightly. Now, the factors in South Asia are, number one, younger age group, therefore less probability of high risk. Secondly, we also have much larger rural populations. These are protective in two ways. Firstly, the spread of the virus is slower in rural areas because there is less crowd density. People also commute shorter distances to work and meet less number of people. Also, the various risk factors that are associated with higher mortality, like hypertension, diabetes, coronary heart disease, are much lower in rural areas than in urban areas in India and South Asia. So all of these factors actually are likely to be favorable for preventing the deaths, though the relative weakness of the health system in terms of service provision is going to be a problem in rural areas if the epidemic really flares up there in a big way.
Now, you've talked about how the death rate relative to the size of India's population is relatively low. The trajectory of daily confirmed cases in India is by far the steepest in the world, almost double that of Brazil and the U.S. What steps are being taken to curb the spread of the virus, especially now as the country reopens?
Well, we do need to bring down the infectivity rate and the test positivity rate. And for that, we do need a much greater emphasis on reducing crowded events, which are super spreader events. We do need to get people to wear masks much more effectively and ensure that even as we are doing that, the testing is accompanied by good contact tracing. Previously, there was a lot of preoccupation with strengthening hospital care facilities, thinking that we'll require a lot of people in intensive care, a lot of people going needing ventilators and so on. Now we know that it's a very small fraction, less than 1%, who require ventilators. Therefore, the attention is now shifted to home care. The state of Delhi started it first and other states are taking it up, saying that 80% of the people do not need hospitalization. Let them be managed at home. Primary care teams will visit them and provide them support if required. And if they need transfer to the hospital, that will be arranged. So in a sense, the reprioritization of our services towards primary health care has begun, but that is what needs to be strengthened much more for early detection of cases, more efficient contact tracing, and cutting down the infectivity rate, even as we are taking care of the people who are already infected.
Professor Srinath Reddy is the president of the Public Health Foundation of India. I want to thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Fires in the Brazilian Amazon in August were at their worst in a decade. That's according to Reuters, citing data from Brazil's Space Research Agency, which monitors wildfires via satellite.
It seems like a little bit of everything is burning in Brazil.
Michelle Calamandine is an expert on deforestation at the University of Cambridge. She says in the first 7 months of 2020, more than 5,000 square miles of the Brazilian Amazon burned. These fires are used to clear land for farming, grazing, or mining.
Fire tends to be sort of your end product of a deforestation process. So they cut the trees down and then they use fire in order to clear the land.
Calamandine says the bad fire season is partly due to lax environmental enforcement and partly because the economic downturn has driven more people into the forest to clear land for farming and mining.
A lot more of these activities are going to occur in these spaces in order to sort of combat the pandemic and the sort of loss of jobs and livelihood that have occurred.
Harvard University health and environment expert Marcia Castro says she's worried about the smoke. Last year's fires sent plumes all the way to Sao Paulo, and it was devastating for human health.
There was an excess of 2,195 hospitalizations because of respiratory diseases just in the Amazon region last year.
She says most of those affected were the elderly or infants.
The same thing is going to happen this year. The trend is horrible. It hasn't changed from last year. And it's 2 years in a row where what we see is basically destruction, starting from cutting the forest and then burning the forest.
Making matters worse this year, Brazil has the second highest coronavirus case count in the world.
If we have another outbreak of cases of COVID, the situation can be much worse because people would be already debilitated with respiratory conditions.
Later on in today's show, we'll be looking at how granting full land rights to indigenous communities helps prevent deforestation in parts of the Amazon. That's in this week's Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. In Iran, something unprecedented has been happening in recent days. Dozens of women have spoken out about sexual harassment and abuse, and they're posting their stories online. That's not easy in Iran, where proving rape in court is difficult. And a rape conviction often means the perpetrator is sentenced to death. The World's Shirin Jafari brings us the story.
For 14 years, Sara Ommatali kept silent. When it happened to her, she was a young, up-and-coming journalist living in Iran. The Islamic Republic is a conservative country where sex is taboo and survivors are often told to keep quiet for the sake of the family's honor.
For many years, I was worried about the consequences and more importantly, about the reactions I will get from people around me.
Ommatali also worried about being blamed herself for what had happened, about losing her job, retaliation.
I knew that by speaking up about what happened to me, I will be known as a troublemaker and it would be added to all limitations and barriers that I faced.
The incident haunts her to this day. She doesn't want to recount the details, but last month she decided it was time to speak out.
I asked myself, why are you still silent? And I didn't have a proper answer, so I decided to write about it on my Twitter account.
In a series of posts, Ommatali said a prominent artist sexually assaulted her when she went to interview him. He showed up to their meeting naked, she says, and then forced himself on her. He tried to kiss her, but she ran away. The artist has denied the accusations. Ommatali says she was encouraged to speak up after seeing accounts of other Iranian women online. In recent days, dozens of Iranians, mostly women, have come forward to share their stories of sexual harassment, assault, and rape. In one case, several young women accused the bookstore owner in Tehran of inviting them to his home, drugging them, and sexually assaulting them. The social media posts have gone viral and sparked outrage. They prompted officials in Iran to take action. This week, Tehran's police chief said the bookstore owner has been arrested and confessed to his crimes. He urged other survivors to come forward, and many are. Leila Rahimi, a lawyer in Tehran, says she's been getting a flood of calls. She's offering legal help for free. Rahimi says the recent Twitter posts show that attitudes towards reporting sexual abuse are slowly changing in Iran.
The younger generation, she says, is more open about discussing sexual abuse.
There is no reliable data on the number of sexual assault cases in Iran. One sociologist estimates that more than 80% of cases go unreported. Legal expert Pega Bani Hashemi says for the situation to improve, Iran has to do two things. One, is to update laws in the country to define sexual harassment more broadly, not just rape as a criminal offense. And two, Iranian schools need to start teaching sex ed. In the absence of formal education, activists are stepping in. They're using the momentum created by the social media campaign to raise awareness about consent and sexual harassment. One example is this video put together by a group of Iranian women. If a woman is wearing a revealing outfit, it doesn't mean she's interested in sleeping with you, one speaker says. Another one adds, if she comes to your home for a visit, she's not giving you a green light. Other speakers go on to describe different scenarios. But the main message of the campaign is this.
Na, yani na, hamishe va har vaqt.
No means no. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Yesterday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel had strong words about the poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
Wir erwarten, dass die russische Regierung sich zu diesem Vorgang erklärt.
We expect the Russian government to explain its position on this case, she said. Now, prominent figures in Germany want Merkel to go even further and ditch a proposed energy pipeline between Germany and Russia. Yuval Weber is following these developments closely. He's a professor of Russian military and political strategy at Marine Corps University. Professor Weber, Merkel's comment, is this the strongest condemnation of Russia that we've heard from her?
Yes, she used the phrase in her press conference of, this is attempted murder, this is a criminal case, and this is something that Russia must answer for. Usually she's the person who's trying to moderate U.S. opposition to Russia and its foreign policy agenda in the region, which obviously has included things such as interference in the Brexit election, annexation of Crimea, the intervention into the war in Ukraine. So it was surprising for how aggressive it was relative to her previous record with Russia.
There are prominent German politicians now saying the Navalny incident should mark the death knell of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. What is this pipeline and why has it become a bargaining chip here?
The big idea here is that Russia has wanted to increase its gas sales to Europe for a long time now. Oil and gas sales are one of the main ways that Russia makes money on the open market. This particular pipeline goes from Russia through the Baltic Sea and into Germany and promises a source of cheap gas. The opposition to this pipeline is that the cheap gas in Europe and the cheap gas inside of Germany would make Germany more open to Russia's political interests. And that's the thing of which her opposition, and I would say a number of people in her own party, have long been against.
How far along is the pipeline?
It's about 93.5% done, just 160 kilometers more to go. So this would be a fairly shocking thing at the very end for her to do something like pull the permission or the permits or what have you for actually bringing it onto land.
As you say, Merkel has defended the pipeline even recently. Do you think Navalny's poisoning will change that?
There is a very big chance. So in addition to opposition from within her own country and within her own party, there's been opposition from the United States. There's been opposition from across Europe on this particular pipeline. Now, Merkel doesn't want to seem that she is caving into pressure from Donald Trump or from anyone outside the country, but this could very well serve as something that could basically stop this particular pipeline and at the same time stand up for European values and German values to say to the Russians, look, we could sanction you, we could do asset freezes. It's clear that you don't care about any of these because Russia's been sanctioned for basically, you know, just about everything under the sun over the past 8 years. So the only thing that Putin really does care about is this pipeline, increasing gas sales, and this style of hardball politics. So for her to actually take this opportunity and bring this pipeline to an end, that would be something that could change Russian foreign policy in a significant way.
What's your gut sense? Do you think Merkel's going to pull the plug on the pipeline?
I think the gut sense is that what she might do is perhaps suspend construction of this pipeline for a couple months in order to allow the case of Navalny, you know, for his health to recover, to see what happens from there and see how this thing plays out.
Yuval Weber is a professor at Marine Corps University and at Texas A&M's Bush School of Government and Public Service. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much.
This is The World. The port explosion in Beirut last month ripped through historical buildings. It didn't take long to see that preserving them would be difficult.
On Tuesday, the blast happened. On Thursday, we've had investors. They were on the street trying to take advantage of what happened.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. The Amazon is sometimes called the lungs of the world. The rainforest produces one-fifth of our planet's oxygen. Right now, those lungs are filled with smoke. The Amazon is likely seeing its worst fires in a decade. A new study shows that one key to protecting the rainforest is to protect indigenous people's land rights. That's the topic of today's Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
In our weekly look at climate change solutions, the world's Anna Kussmer reports on the value of protecting indigenous land rights.
Growing up between Brazil and Colombia, Dayara Tucano learned from her family what it meant to care for nature, how to help protect plants, animals, and rivers.
Indigenous peoples, in a general way, know that humankind is not the center of the universe. We learn with nature around us because we are part of nature.
She says indigenous lands, including the Tucano territory in northern Brazil, are rich with biodiversity.
And the way of continuing to be rich as a territory is being the source of enormous diversity that is not just biodiversity, but cultural diversity as well.
The Amazon is constantly under threat of illegal clearing and burning. About a quarter of the rainforest is federally recognized indigenous territory. Most, but not all of that land, has full legal land rights. That allows communities to use the land as they see fit with greater protection from illegal invasions. University of San Diego researcher Catherine Baraguanath wanted to know if those official land rights helped indigenous communities better protect their land.
What we're trying to learn is whether these collective property rights give indigenous tribes the tool to curb deforestation inside their lands.
A study she recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that they did. Deforestation was 2/3 lower on legally designated indigenous lands compared to other parts of the forest. She says that's partly because these areas are patrolled and have monitoring systems that alert authorities if there's illegal logging.
What we find is that these collective rights are very effective, but only when they are fully granted. So in Brazil, in order to get these property rights, you have to go through a pretty long, lengthy process.
Research has shown that in many cases, indigenous lands around the world are better protected and have higher rates of biodiversity than other areas. And since the late 80s, Brazil's government has recognized that indigenous land rights are essential for environmental conservation.
We recognize this as Brazilian government.
Former Environment Minister Isabella Teixeira says that was a core idea in a 2012 policy guaranteeing the rehabilitation and conservation of indigenous lands.
We developed these public policies and also different tools, and we managed together with indigenous people based on their priorities how we can prevent, for example, fires.
Teixeira says her ministry's fire prevention plans were developed alongside indigenous experts. But in 2018, things took a turn. Ecologist Philip Fernside at the National Institute for Research in Amazonia says President Jair Bolsonaro is known to oppose indigenous land rights.
During his campaign, one of his slogans was not going to allow creation of another single centimeter of indigenous land. So that leaves those places open to being invaded by gold miners and loggers and everything.
Now, illegal deforestation is on the rise as land grabbers, miners, and loggers take advantage of lax environmental enforcement. Nearly 30,000 fires are currently burning in the Amazon, many of them illegally set to clear land for farming. Luis Eloy is a lawyer with Brazil's Indigenous People Articulation and a member of the Terena Indigenous Community in central Brazil. He helps indigenous communities fight for their land rights in the courts.
The prosecution and criminalization of indigenous leaders, which has been more abrupt and direct during Bolsonaro's government, has created a hate discourse against indigenous people. It's driven by racism.
Last year, there was a spike in the number of indigenous activists murdered in Brazil. So securing land rights is more than protecting the environment for indigenous communities.
It's impossible to speak about indigenous life without talking about the preservation of those territories. I mean, the land is the physical base where all other rights originate: the right to life, culture, identity, and health.
Activist Dayara Tucano says President Bolsonaro isn't the only problem. Farmers burn the rainforest to grow soybeans or graze cattle for international export. So as long as there's demand from consumers in places like China and elsewhere, the incentive for destruction will continue.
We need you to stop polluting. We need you to stop eating so much meat. And what do you use that soybean for? We need you to stop consuming the products of the big agro industries that are invading indigenous territories, that are killing people, and because they are also killing you.
Local land rights are an important start. But addressing the root causes of deforestation requires a global effort. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
From planting urban forests to suing governments over inaction on climate change, The Big Fix gives us a chance each week to think about climate change solutions. We're exploring how people and organizations around the planet are tackling the climate crisis, and we welcome your questions about climate change solutions. Email us at climate@theworld.org and find more of our Big Fix stories at theworld.org/bigfix. The United States has announced sanctions against senior members of the International Criminal Court, including its chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda. She's been leading an investigation into possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. sanctions, which include a travel ban and the freezing of assets in the U.S., is the sort of punishment usually reserved for leaders of rogue states and members of criminal gangs. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told Fox News yesterday why he thinks the International Criminal Court fits this category.
This is a group of political hacks in The Hague, a place that is threatening our kids who served in Afghanistan, our young men and women who served and fought there. This is a rogue court with lawyers that are frankly corrupt and political, and they are threatening to prosecute Americans who engaged in America's fight for freedom in Afghanistan.
Liz Evenson is Associate International Justice Director at Human Rights Watch in Washington. She's been following this. Liz, first things first, remind us what the International Criminal Court, known as the ICC, what it is and what power it has to prosecute individuals.
The International Criminal Court, it's what it says it is. It's a global court that conducts criminal trials. It doesn't put states on trial. It puts individuals on trial for what we think of as the worst crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes. It was set up by the international community through a treaty. It has 123 countries that belong to it. This is a court that only steps in when national authorities don't investigate and prosecute, when victims really have nowhere else to look for justice.
Well, I want to move to the ICC's Afghanistan investigation. What is it and what does it have to do with Americans? What are they investigating?
The vast majority of the investigation is focused on alleged crimes carried out by the Taliban, but also those by Afghan government forces, and also alleged torture and other ill treatment of detainees by U.S. personnel. And that includes CIA or U.S. military personnel.
And what years are we talking about in terms of when these alleged war crimes took place?
We're talking about in Afghanistan itself since 2003. And the reason why the court would be able to do this, the reason why an investigation could include conduct by Americans, is because the court has a mandate to look at crimes committed in Afghanistan or connected to the conflict in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan actually belongs to this court.
So what crimes are being investigated that are linked to Americans in Afghanistan?
The prosecutor has indicated that one area of focus for her investigation could be looking at the very well-documented torture and other serious abuses against detainees that were alleged to have been committed by U.S. military and CIA personnel in Afghanistan, but also in other countries that belong to the ICC, Lithuania, Poland, and Romania, where some of these abuses are alleged to have taken place.
And you're referring to those black sites where people were picked up, taken to these sites in Eastern Europe and other places.
That's right.
Now, could this ICC investigation, as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo suggests, lead to the prosecution of Americans who served in Afghanistan?
The way the court works is it's a court of last resort, and it also tends to focus on those who bear the greatest responsibility. So if the investigation goes forward, the prosecutor will be looking to see who bears the most responsibility for these kinds of crimes. So these tends to be not necessarily even those who carry out the crimes themselves, who carry out torture, but who was responsible for authorizing those acts of torture, or also military or civilian leaders who might have known that abuses were taking place, but didn't take action to stop them, didn't take action to hold individuals carrying them out to account. So the focus of the court's investigations tends to be at higher levels of leadership.
Is there any practical impact of these sanctions that have been announced by the Trump administration on the ability of Fatou Bensouda to do her job and to go on with this investigation?
It seems very clear that the intent of these sanctions is to, at the very least, intimidate, you know, and scare off ICC officials from doing their job and provide justice to victims. I think it remains to be seen what the effect of the sanctions will be on the work of the court. And I think what's important now is really for all the countries that belong to the ICC to make clear that they're not deterred by this sort of bullying action by the U.S. administration, that they support this court, that they know what a vital role it has to play as a court of last resort for victims.
Liz Evenson is with Human Rights Watch. She's been explaining the growing row between the White House and the International Criminal Court. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In a matter of moments on August 4th, a huge section of the city of Beirut was destroyed. Thousands of homes and commercial buildings were heritage structures. They'd survived the country's 15-year civil war. But now many of those buildings are at risk of not being restored or rebuilt. And Beirut is at risk of losing its unique architectural fabric. Rebecca Collard reports.
Yes, it was my bedroom. That's my bed for my wife.
On the top floor of the home built by his grandparents, Henri Azar shows me the room he shared with his wife for half a century. The window is blown out and the sun seeps through holes in the ceiling.
This brick, it was built with a brick over.
Above this?
Yes. Now there is nothing.
Azar shows me through what's left of his three-story family home with its high ceilings and marble floors. What was once the north-facing wall of his living room is now just a gaping void. Looking out, there's a panoramic view of his neighborhood, destroyed. Inside, remnants of his family's shattered life are strewn around the living room. Furniture, magazines, and a portrait of Jesus.
The house of my grandfather. And we lived here since 100 years. Grandfather built the house.
Where were you when it happened?
We were outside. There was a ceremony at the mountain. And we were out. And when we come, nothing.
The blast on August 4th ripped through some of Beirut's oldest neighborhoods. It damaged or destroyed more than 40,000 buildings, many of them heritage homes like Azar's. An estimated 300,000 people were made homeless. That includes Azar and his wife, who are staying with relatives outside Beirut. The Azars estimate the damage to their home to be about $200,000, money they don't have. Azar hopes the government will help out, but Lebanon is $90 billion in debt and there's swaths of the city to rebuild. Meanwhile, real estate investors are circling, says Naji Raji, a preservation activist with Save Beirut Heritage.
On Tuesday, the blast happened. On Thursday, we've had news of investors. They were on the street trying to take advantage of what happened and the weakness of the people at that time. We hope that they didn't succeed.
Many homeowners now face a difficult decision. Sell their family homes to investors knowing they will likely be torn down and replaced by a high-rise, or risk becoming homeless because they don't have the funds to rebuild. Raji says that engineers have begun visiting homes to assess damage, but that real estate companies are sending their own engineers to neighborhoods to trick people into leaving.
Some engineers are paid by these companies to give fake assessments and to convince these people that they need to right away leave from this house because it's going to collapse on their heads.
And why would they do that?
To take advantage.
If investors win and homes like Azar's are destroyed, Beirut could lose a big swath of its distinctive architecture, a medley of Arab, Ottoman, and French colonial buildings. Some say that's what happened to the city's downtown, which was once the heart of Beirut. Old structures damaged during the country's civil war were replaced by modern ones, and the city center was never the same. Raji and his fellow activists are trying to keep that from happening again. They've set up a fund to help people like the Azars repair their homes. But with so many houses damaged, the cost is big.
And my low estimation, it would be like maybe $120, $150 million.
That's just heritage buildings, and so far they've raised only $100,000, though Naji says millions more have been pledged. Several other initiatives are also trying to help people repair their homes. Shortly after the explosion, a law was passed barring the sale of property in the blast-affected area. But Raji says he has little faith that law will protect the people.
Because protecting heritage means a big, big loss for their construction companies and their investment companies.
Back on the Azhar Street, banners hang from buildings with the words, "We are staying," in thick red letters. Inside his home, Azhar shows me the east side of the apartment, which was hit by a rocket during the Civil War.
We'll fix it.
They repaired it and stayed, he says. But now there is much more damage. A wall is missing, a cabinet in the kitchen holds up a section of the roof. Smashed doors and windows lay in piles on the floor. A team of engineers arrives to survey the damage, these ones with official IDs from the syndicate. In the apartment below, they point to a deep crack in the wall where it looks like the two rooms that the wall divides might literally fall away from each other. The glass and frames are blown out of the traditional three-arch windows in the front of the building. It will cost, say the engineers, but it's repairable. From the window, crews can be seen already repairing a building on the other side of the street, a modern high-rise recently built. The Azhar's home is on what's become a busy street filled with restaurants and bars before the blast. It's prime real estate. And Henri Azhar says they have had many offers to sell since the explosion.
So many, but we told them not for sale. That's my ancestor's house. I couldn't.
But for now, he also can't rebuild. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
Pop culture loves a good revenge story, even when the villain isn't human.
Smile, you son of a bitch!
That, of course, was Roy Scheider's character taking out a giant great white in Jaws. And in real life, there's often a move to seek swift revenge on sharks who attack humans. In Western Australia, the government runs a controversial catch-and-kill program. Bad news for sharks in the area, but a recent incident is different. It started with one surfer's terrifying encounter.
I called out, "Shark, shark." And then once I was on the board, I realized, I'm probably on my own here. I don't really know how this is going to go down. I think maybe this is it for me.
That's Chantal Doyle speaking to Nine News in Australia. She was surfing in Port Macquarie, New South Wales. That shark she saw, unfortunately, was apparently hungry because it chomped on her leg.
I knew it wasn't an accident. It was a very intentional thwack. Like a teenage boy at the pantry, just like, nom, 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 what can I eat?
Doyle's partner, Mark Rapley, was there too. He hopped off his surfboard and started punching the shark.
Just was that flurry of punches. You're not focused on how you're doing it.
And it worked. The animal eventually swam away. But Doyle was left with a seriously injured right leg. She's still recovering in the hospital. So you might expect, at the very least, some resentment toward the creature responsible for her attack. Instead, Doyle and Rapley started a crowdfunding campaign to raise money for the Australian Marine Conservation Society. The campaign is appropriately called Punching for Healthy Oceans. On the fundraising page, they write, "Healthy oceans mean a better future for everyone." And that includes protecting sharks and their habitats. They've raised over $10,000 Australian so far. Doyle says the idea is simple.
Stand up firmly and proudly for looking after what we have here, because it is slipping away.
She says what happened to her was not an attack, but an encounter. A scary encounter, but one she hopes will end up benefiting sharks, too. Ghana is famous for its textiles, full of vibrant colors and striking, repeating patterns. But if you look more closely at the fabric produced in recent months by one Ghanaian textile company, you'll notice something unusual about those patterns. They're padlocks, airplanes, keys. This series of fabric designs was inspired by the coronavirus pandemic. The Reverend Stephen Kofi Badu is the marketing director at Textiles Ghana Limited in Timma, Ghana. Stephen, describe some of the designs in this series. What kind of motifs are we seeing?
We looked at the lockdown measures that were put in place by the president, President Nana Akufo-Addo. So we came up with motifs that suggest or that depict some of the measures. So, for example, one of the images is the use of plane, the plane engine, in the way it's saying that airplanes were all grounded, no flights were allowed in or out of the country.
I know one of your designs shows a pattern featuring a round pair of glasses. What's the significance of that?
We got that inspiration from President Nana Akufo-Addo. Since March this year, he's been addressing the nation through televised broadcast. And every time he comes to address the nation, he has a trademark spectacle, very small, rounded spectacles that he wears. And that stands out in his face. And so for us, that became like the key motif to represent his leadership and how he managed the whole COVID-19 pandemic in our country.
I want to ask you what inspired this series. I mean, you're putting images into your fabric that relate to a pandemic, which is kind of, you know, it's kind of depressing and sad. Why bring images of that to fabric and textiles in Ghana? Ghana is so famous for its textiles.
It's a question that almost everybody asks. Why did we even think about putting an image of something that is so bad into a fabric? As a company, we are storytellers. We tell our stories through designs and colors. Okay, so in Ghana, almost every major things that happen, we try to express that through our designs. So the question we ask ourselves is, how do we tell the story of COVID-19 in a positive light? How do we put a positive twist to this whole pandemic? And so far, it's been received quite well.
Has the textile industry in Ghana been hit hard by the pandemic?
Yes, the pandemic indeed slowed down sales drastically. Prior to the pandemic, we were selling an average of about 1 million yards per month. By the close of the month of March, our sales had dropped to about over 100,000. And so really, it affected us really, really badly. So for us, the introduction of our new collection sort of brought some energy, fresh, positive energy to the industry. People were just enthused about the whole idea of a COVID-inspired fabric. And out of that curiosity, people felt, let me get a piece just to remember, show it to my children, show it to my grandchildren, that once upon a time, something like COVID-19, a pandemic of this nature, came upon the world. So I think that's what inspired a lot of people to go out there and pick a piece to keep for memory.
I understand that you have a series of new COVID-inspired designs. What can we expect to see?
We call this collection, which we introduced the 1st of September, we call it "This Too Shall Pass." For example, the first design has motifs that depict movement from a state of barrenness to a better state of flourishing. So you'll find like a tree. For half part of the tree, the leaves are all withered and it's very barren and there's a drought all around. The other half of it, it shows a flourishing tree, you know. So basically, it's to say that, yes, today there is barrenness, there's drought, there's famine, everything is withered. But there is hope that once the rains come, this same tree would flourish. So it's a way of giving Ghanaians and indeed the world at large hope that we will survive this COVID.
Reverend Stephen Kofi Badu is the marketing director for Textiles Ghana Limited. He's been speaking to us from Timma, Ghana. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you too.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.